But again, feel free to use the raise hand feature in Zoom if you want to speak up. Or then, as Juha mentioned, you can just type your question in chat and I'll try to be checking, or Juha will be poking me every now and then to see if there's any important questions that needs to be answered, okay? And please ask questions, okay? So this is the way we all learn, okay? By asking the questions. So don't be shy, use these opportunities to speak up as well. All right, so here's the overview for the today's and tomorrow's lectures. So we'll start today with trying to understand what is happening in the banking sector right now. Okay, so we'll try to figure out what's the meaning and what are the differences between the digital and traditional conventional banks, as they're called. And then we'll try to figure out what are the components or elements of the digital banking. All right, so we'll also see what's happening in the financial markets right now, what kind of digital disruption there is and what it means for the financial intermediation. So, and then also, of course, we'll try to figure out what are the forms, are they different at first place? And what if they are, what are the exact forms of the digital banks? And what is their functions as financial intermediaries? All right, and then we'll finish today with the economics of some sort of a general economics of banking and fintechs. So the biggest question here, and I think this is relevant for many interested parties. So the question is, can actually the fintechs or digital banks replace the conventional banks or traditional banks in their primary activities? Okay, and tomorrow we're gonna be looking at the grounds for the regulations of the fintechs and whether it has any implications for the financial stability in general, because this is a rather important question right now from the regulator and supervisory point of view. So we're going to see whether these regulations kind of trigger the appearance of any shadow banks, for example, in the economy. And then what are the implications for the financial stability of this rise of the shadow banks or fintechs and so on and so forth. And then basically we'll try to figure out what's the main challenge. Why is it so difficult basically to regulate or to try to regulate the digital banks, and whether there actually should be a different regulation for digital banks than for conventional banks. Okay. And then, yeah, as I told you, we're going to be having a case study. So the main idea of this case study is to basically to try to trace what's the impact of the rise of this fintech on the market structure in general. Okay, so what kind of implications it has for the rest of the market. Okay, and then as the final part for tomorrow, we will try to see whether the monetary policy transmission channels still can be used in the same manner for digital banks as they were used with the conventional banks, for instance. Okay, so this is kind of a broad topic, but we'll try to take a quick kind of a summary of that and try to figure out the most important aspects in that. Okay. So let's roll. So let's try to see what's happening with the market right now. So I'll show you a few graphs, and they're relatively new. They're relatively based on the recent data. Of course, they're not to 2020, but most of them are relatively recent. But I can assure you that the picture doesn't change that much. Okay, so I actually checked, and the picture doesn't change that much. So if there is a downward slope in any of the graphs, so you can be pretty much sure that it's going to be downward sloping in the most recent periods as well. Okay, so the first one, this is just the number of branches of the like physical branches of banks in the EU between the past 10, 11 years. Okay, so we can see that, for instance, just before the financial crisis hit, there was some sort of an uptick. So if you take an older period there, so you will see that there is a pretty much the same situation was going on. So there was a growing number of physical branches of the commercial banks. So after the financial crisis, so since the 2008, we actually observe a very, very kind of, well, relatively steep, sorry about that. So a very relatively steep downward slope in the number of physical branches of banks. Okay, so this is in thousands. So if in 2009 or 2008, we had roughly 237,000, then in 2017, we already had less than 200. Okay, so it's actually 183,000. So the number of registered banks also is decreasing. So since 2008, we lost about 27% of the registered banks in the EU. And roughly every fourth branch in the whole EU, if you take an average, was shut down. Okay. So between 2017 and 16 only, there were 70 credit institutions that were closed in Germany, for instance, 65 closed in Italy. While in Finland, even if you consider Finland as a relatively small country and relatively small banking sector, there were 12 branches that were closed down. I call it branches because this is mostly related to the OPE or OP cooperative bank. So some of the branches of the cooperatives were shut down in some of the regions. Okay, so Sweden is a little bit an outlier here. So in Sweden, we actually have seen some sort of a small increase in the number of financial institutions. So they got three more. So it would be actually interesting to see what kind of institutions they are. So I would be curious to see that later on. Okay, so the second graph is that the number of individuals employed by the banks in the EU. So I know that you are all doing a master's degree in banking, but I'm not sure if this is going to be a very good news for you if you're planning to enter the banking market anytime soon as the potential employee of the bank. So this is the number, the left-hand side graph is the number of bank staff in millions. Okay, again, this is coming, this data is from the 28 EU countries. Okay, so if on the onset or amidst the financial crisis, the number was relatively fixed, so it was a little bit over 3 million. But then actually after the financial crisis, so basically starting from 2010-11, there was a steep downward slope. So now it's actually 2.74. was in 2017, now it's a little less. And actually, just a couple of days ago, I read that there were another 60,000 jobs were cut from the banking sector in the EU. So probably this is not good news for you, but I'm sure that there is a way, or there is actually a reason, first of all, why the number of jobs is decreasing in the banking sector. And then, as you will see later on, this is actually related only to very, very specific type of the banking jobs. And most of them are related, of course, to the front office operations. So I'm sure that having a master's degree in banking would not really put you in the front office of the bank. So, okay, so let's look at the right-hand side graph. So this is the number of credit institutions in general. So, and you can see that, again, there is a obvious decrease in the number of financial institutions in general in the EU and also in the EU in the euro area. So we can see that something is obviously happening. Okay, so potential reasons for that could be twofold, right? So the first one could be that the banking sector is just shrinking, so there are becoming less banks, so less banking assets. And then the second reason is got to be something more structural, right? So there got to be something which is not necessarily related with the size of the banking sector, but it's rather related with the way how the banking sector is functioning right now. Okay, and in order to answer this question, we can look at the simple graph of the total assets of the EU banking sector. So this is between 2011 and 2019. So you can see that actually, well, of course there are up and downs, but it seems like the if you take the moving average, some sort of a moving average line here, So you can actually see that the growth of the total assets of the banking sector is rather cyclical, right? So it goes in cycles, which is pretty much relevant for, well, most of the industries. And there is actually, there is no obvious correlation between the number of banks or number of physical branches and the size of the banking sector, because we've seen that during all this period, there was a decline in both in the number of banks and the number of physical branches. Okay, so we also don't observe or we don't kind of register any massive account closures or some sort of incidence of large withdrawals of the for example deposits or in general the banking licenses. So the question is here, what's happening? And it seems like it's not about the shrinkage of the banking sector, but it's rather about the how the banking sector is functioning, right? So in a nutshell, well, you probably guessed this lecture is about digital banks, but in a nutshell, is what happened is that from basically coming from this type of the banking business, way of making the business, we are ending up in this kind of way of making the banking business. Okay, I have a very so if you got the slides, there is actually a link. So it's a very short video, and this is just, you know, just to give you a snapshot how this digital banking looks like already to some extent and how it will look in the nearest future. Okay, so I'm just gonna open the, I hope the YouTube gonna work now for all of us, but let's see. So so let me check just here. So you should have a sound, and you should also have the video. Okay, so it's 2 minutes. Just let's quickly watch it, and then we can discuss it very quickly.
Hello, bank manager.
Hi, Maria. What can I do for you?
Summary of accounts, please. Festival savings. Transfer £200 from festival savings to current account. Reference ticket purchase.
Hey, Maria. We have a partnership with X Tickets. What tickets do you want to purchase?
2 tickets for Berlin Festival?
Sure. These tickets come on sale in a few seconds. Do you want us to purchase them automatically as soon as they're available?
Yes.
Congratulations. Please authenticate on your purchase. We can provide help and advice for your upcoming trip. Would you like to know more?
What can you offer?
Account to save on fees and booking a flight soon as availability is rapidly reducing since festival tickets went on sale.
Let's do it. So we are going to Berlin.
All right, so I hope you were able to see the picture as well as the sound, so I hope it worked nicely. If not, you have a link and you can look at it later on as well. So there is a link on this picture, you can just, it's clickable. So, I mean, fascinating, right? So if you would ever think that instead of going to the bank and trying to arrange things, like for example, opening a multi-currency account or arranging in general the transfers of, from your saving accounts. So before, you actually had to be in a physical line, actually in a physical branch, and try to do all these operations. So now you can do everything online. You don't have to contact with the bank at all, with anyone from the bank personnel. And then it seems like it's going to the way where much more of the services can be offered, and then they can be bundled together. And that is going to be like a one-stop shop for many other financial services, and not only financial services, but whenever there is a financial transaction involved, it seems like it can be somehow integrated in the everyday banking activity. Right. So basically, what is different right now already, and what makes the banking sector different already today, is that basically opening a bank account is nothing more difficult than, for example, signing up for Facebook or creating a profile on Facebook. So the most of the services for daily banking activities are available 24/7, even if you need to do some cross-border activities. So before, it was not actually possible at all. And then you can do basically whatever savings or investments you want at any time of the day. And all you need is just the online verification, right? You either type your password or some sort of the PIN code and so on and so forth. And then you're done, right? So you get the service. So there's a very, very few human interactions in everyday banking activities. So you don't have to sign the papers. You don't have to go to the bank physically. Basically, most of the things you can do with your mobile phone, right? So mobile access is rather common nowadays, right? So, but the question is here: does this actually, all these features, make the bank fully digital? Okay. So quite commonly, people actually have some sort of a misunderstanding what the digital bank is. So let's try to figure out what's the idea behind this digital banking, and what are the common fallacies, and what's the correct definitions of the digital banking. So the common fallacies is that internet banking is equal to digital banking. Okay, so this is not the case. This is not true. So internet banking is just a tool which is used in the digital banking and digital banks. Okay. So a mobile app makes a bank digital. Again, this is not true. So mobile apps, they make things easier and more accessible in a sense. But again, if the bank has a mobile app, it doesn't make the bank digital automatically, right? So then there are all the other features, fancy chatbots or trading and savings, online advisors, and so on and so forth. So some people think that this is what makes the bank digital. Okay, so this is again not the case. So they do reduce the interactions with the human based on the predefined algorithm, right? So they're still created, but essentially this is not what kind of describes or what makes the bank digital, all right? And then another thing is that a bank without branches, without physical branches, is automatically digital. Well, to some extent, of course, it is. It somehow needs to provide a service, so most likely it's in the digital form. But essentially, it still doesn't make the bank fully digital, right? So we've got, first of all, some of the services still require a physical presence, right? So more or less, you still would need to communicate with somebody. For example, even if your credit card will be delivered by post, you would still be basically interacting with the post office, for instance, right? So just in order to get your credit card. And there are many, many other services that require some sort of either a physical presence or physical communication with the people in the bank. So I'm not going to go into detail on this part. But essentially, the bottom line here is that even if the bank doesn't have branches, physical branches, it still doesn't make this bank digital. All right, so let's try to figure out what's actually the digital bank is. So let's put it this way, in the pseudo-digital bank or in the semi-digital bank, we have, as in any bank, front and back office, right? So the front office could be, for example, the internet or mobile banking. And this is going to be the customer side, right? So the front office is the customer side. So nowadays, it's mostly automated, okay? So the interaction of the customer with the front office is mostly automated. So the person doesn't need to go to the physical branch in order to do some sort of a daily banking activity, right? And then the other side, the bank side, so the back office. So this is where all the clearances and record maintenance and regulatory compliance and accounting are happening. So this is happening on the bank side or at the back office. And from the bank side, it's actually mostly automated as well, right? So for example, the accounting part nowadays is highly automated. So there is no need to create a T-accounts anymore, keep the physical books of your accounts. So most of the things are automated. The clearances are automated nowadays as well. So the thing is that there is actually a very, very important connection between the front office and the back office, because whenever you do something in the front office, it needs to be registered in the back office as well, right? So it needs to go through the clearance or the some sort of record maintenance. So if you do it within your own accounts, it's fine, it's no problem. But if it has to do with external parties as well, then there's actually a problem. So in a semi-digital bank or in a pseudo-digital bank, this process is not automated, right? So for example, when you come to the bank and you apply for instance, for a mortgage, right? So you can do it online, most likely. You can fill in the application. But then actually somebody from the bank needs to either accept or not accept your application and then go through this application, get probably more data from your other account, from your credit history, for instance, and then make you some sort of an offer with the corresponding interest rate, right? So this is kind of a very thin line, which makes kind of all the difference, right? So in the non-digital banks, this part, the connection part between the front office and the back office are not automated, okay? So all these connections are still need to be done physically by some bank employees, okay? So in the digital bank, this part is automated, okay? On top of the fully automated, the front office and the back office, the connection between these two are fully automated. And this is what makes the bank really digital, okay? So this is some sort of a full transformation of the front end and the back end operations. So these automated functions, they can be trained. So for example, when you apply for the loan, it's not a person anymore. It's rather some sort of a technological function or algorithm which makes the decision instead of the bank employee, right? So it's very easy. Nowadays, it's applied in some of the banks, and it's actually fairly simple algorithm which takes into account a certain level of details in the data, in the hard data, for example, your credit history or your saving behavior or investment behavior as well. And then it makes some sort of a decision whether to issue the loan for you or not to issue the loan for you, okay? So this is the point where, for example, machine learning or artificial intelligence or big data analysis, blockchain technologies, they all step up in this part in order to make these decisions kind of automated as well. Okay, so it seems like it's fairly complicated game, right? So the question here, why do banks want to become digital at first place? So there are actually three reasons for that, okay? So the first one, and probably one of the most important ones, is that it's all about the efficiency and it's all about the cost reduction and so on and so forth. Yes, it requires a lot in terms of the fixed investments or one-time investments or some sort of during some period of time investments. But essentially, the meaning for that is that the banks would be able to cut costs and become more efficient in their everyday activities, right? And why banks want to do that? It's not because they are some sort of nasty and greasy animals in the field, but this is simply because there are tighter regulations which become t- tighter and tighter every now and then, especially after some sort of a crisis. So I hope that there are not going to be tighter regulations after the current crisis, because it's kind of not emerged from the financial perspective in a sense. But at least after the financial crisis of 2008, there were actually a lot more regulations for financial institutions on how they can do business and what kind of reserves they need to put aside, and all other possible other kinds of regulatory mechanisms that were implemented. Okay, another thing is that, well, we've been living in the era of negative interest rates for quite some time now, right? So, and it seems like it's not going away anytime soon. So for banks, it actually, the bank's margins, they were pretty low already, but now they're getting even lower simply because of all the extra regulations and all the decreases in the interest rates and so on and so forth. So the bank profitability is actually rather a big issue, at least in the EU banking sector. Okay, so the second one is that the second reason why banks want to become digital in the first place is that, well, obviously they want to increase their revenues, right? So the digital banks, they focus on enhanced customer experience, right? So the more people kind of enjoy it, the more people like the services that the bank provides, the more they're going to use it most likely, right? And probably the more there are users, the more banks can generate the profits or the incomes. And then simply, it's all about actually survival, right? So they need to be, the banks need to stay competitive. And this is kind of the a big issue right now for the banking sector, simply because there is a huge pressure and huge disruption is coming from non-bank, some sort of a fintech technologies, which are kind of trying to shake up the banking sector. There are plenty of examples, but probably one of the most notable ones are, for example, Apple or Google or Samsung Pay or mobile pay in general. So in order to kind of stay competitive and to save the market share in this particular area, for example, in the area of payments, banks need to adjust, right? So they need to try to keep up with the competition. So that's how we ended up with having, for example, contactless payment, which is very handy nowadays, especially nowadays, right? So that was pretty much the response to the Apple and Google and Samsung Pay, mobile pay, and so on and so forth, all the other digital disruption. Okay, so the thing is that the banking sector is traditionally and historically is one of the most conservative sectors that you could ever see, okay? So there are very, very long traditions of the banking services. So some banks, they have a clear picture how to do the business and they're not planning to step out of their comfort zone. There are also very high barriers for entry, right? So there are nowadays the capital requirements. Well, in EU, they're more or less the same, but especially in the emerging markets, the capital requirements for the bank, for the newly registered banks, and for all the other existing banks, they're increasing, okay? So from the regulatory point of view to make the system safer and more stable, they're trying to somehow create some sort of a buffers in form of the capital. And that creates the barriers for entry, right? So when you see that the minimum capital requirement is several hundreds of million of euros, for instance, so it's actually not that many players would be interested in entering this market from the scratch, right? So from just establishing a new bank. And then, of course, there is a very, very tight regulatory environment. So whatever you do in the banking sector is regulated. So there is a requirement, there is a capital requirement, liquidity requirement, risk requirements, all possible kinds of risk. When it comes to the credit risk, there are a bunch of other requirements which are under the credit risk regulations. So you cannot loan, for example, or you cannot lend money or you can lend money only to the certain amount to any particular borrower or to affiliated borrowers, okay? So obviously there is a reason for this requirement, for these regulations. But this makes it extremely difficult and extremely hard to enter the market or to enter the sector of the banking services. And this is kind of the reason why the banking sector is traditionally very, very conservative sector. So the thing is that, I don't know if you've been following that much on the development in the fintech or techfin initiative. So most of the innovative products, most of the things we actually use right now in our daily activities, which can be called as the technological innovations, they are originated outside of the banking sector. Okay, so most of the things were produced outside of the banks. So, and as the results, banks are actually enablers of this technology and not creators. Okay, and this is important to understand. So we're trying to figure out what's the difference, how this fintech and how this digital disruption gonna affect the banking sector. And this is a crucial point to understand, that the banking sector are not the ones who are creating this technology. They're the ones who are trying to catch up, right? So let's try to figure out what's the digital banking consists of. What are the elements? So there are actually, if you start being interested in the topic, so you'll find different classifications of and different probably definitions of these elements. But I think this one is pretty much easy to follow and easy to understand. So and it's kind of more intuitive in a sense to understand. So there are basically three big elements of the digital banking today. Okay, so there are new banks. So the new banks, they're also sometimes called challengers. So they are rather rare nowadays. Okay, so they have, these banks have a full banking license, and they offer the same traditional banking services as any other conventional non-digital bank, okay? So the second one is the new bank. So they do not have the banking license. So those are relatively common nowadays. So, but they try to, essentially they try to cooperate with the existing bank in order to offer the bank license services, okay? So this is kind of a, they're kind of banks are not really banks, okay? So they're offering banking services through some sort of other third-party arrangements. And then finally, there are non-bank fintechs. So this is probably the largest sector right now in the digital disruption perspective. So those are the ventures that offer rather limited financial services, but to a broader customer base. Okay, so I'll have a few examples for you just to make it clear what's the difference between all this. Okay, so there is a bank called Monzo. Okay, so it's a fully digital mobile bank founded in 2015 in the UK. All right, so at some stage it actually set the record for the quickest crowdfunding campaign in history. Okay, so it raised 1 million of British pounds just in 96 seconds, all right? So that was the all-time high and all-time faster, well, not all-time, well, the speed of this acquisition of the money was the fastest at least so far. So 1 million in 96 seconds, that's pretty fast, okay? So at some stage in 2008, well, 3 years later, they reached 1 million customers, okay? So currently, as of today, actually, I checked it a couple of weeks ago, the number of customers increased, well, more than four times, okay? So today is 4.4 million. So the market valuations in June 2019 were about 2 billion pounds, okay? So it went down after the COVID-19 experience. So as of July 2010, the market valuations are only 1.25. Okay, so we'll actually come back to this example and if you try to figure out what's happening, why the market valuation dropped so badly for this particular bank. Okay, so essentially, it's a bank which has the banking license, so it has the right to operate in pretty much any licensed banking activities as the usual traditional banks. But as of today, even as of today, despite the fact that it started 5 years ago, it still offers very limited banking services. So it's limited deposits and mostly very small loans or loans to individuals and to the small and medium enterprises. Okay. All right. So just keep it in mind. We will come back to this. to this discussion a little bit later on today. Okay, so then we have a new bank, right? So there's a new bank example called Chime. So this one was founded in 2013. It offers fee-free accounts, which are relatively rare among the US banks. So this is the US venture. So on average, large US banks make about $1 billion a year in total in the fees-related revenues, okay? And then there is a small guy called Chime comes and say, hey, why do you pay this $1 billion? We can offer you the same services for free, okay? So that's a pretty huge kind of disruption for the US banking sector. All right, so how they make money? Well, basically, they do it on the interchange. So interchange means that every time when you make a transaction on the Chime issued Visa card, they work on the Visa. So this is like one of their partners. So a very small kind of a fraction is transferred to the Chime. Okay, so that this fraction is actually paid by the merchant. So if you buy something from Amazon, for instance, so then the seller on the Amazon would pay a very small fraction of this transaction to the Chime. Okay. So this is how they make money. So as of December last year, it had 6.5 million accounts in the US alone. So in February, so it's actually the development, how they were opening these accounts is fascinating. So for example, in February 2018, the Chime registered 10,000 new accounts in 24 hours, okay? So within one day, they opened or they signed or they got 10,000 new customers, all right? So when people started to figure out what's happening, why on earth there are so many people want to open Chime account? Well, it appeared to be that Wells Fargo, one of the largest US banks, had some sort of a day-long outage, all right? So the customers did not have any access to their accounts or they were not able to use the cards, simply because of some sort of a technical failure at Wells Fargo. So I think there was a blackout somewhere in one of the regions, which kind of led to the shutdown of the system. So people were not able to use their cards. They were not able to access their accounts. So they had to wait for one day being unable to make any transaction. All right. So obviously, as a customer, you get pissed off, right? So when you cannot use a card, especially when it's unexpected, you get pissed off and then you try to look for alternative, and Chime was there, especially when it's free. I mean, it's very easy to start opening the accounts. So as February 2020, so just a few months ago, the Chime reported to hit 8 million accounts, right? So within if you meet the first year of the foundation and some sort of a pre-development of the bank, so within roughly 6 years, they reached 8 million accounts, which is pretty large, okay? So when you consider the exposure that this new technology has for the market of the, for example, retail depositors, that's pretty big number, right? 8 million people or 8 million accounts. So the thing is that this is not a real bank, okay? So it doesn't have a banking license. So and this is actually written on their webpage. So I'll try to very, very small letters. So I'll try to zoom it for you. So I hope now you can see and read it. So it says here that the banking services provided are provided by the Bancorp Bank or Stride Bank, which are the members of FDIC. Okay. So this basically they confess here with the small letters that they are not the bank. And all the bank related services or bank license services are provided by the third parties, okay, by some other types of the bank. And then they continue that this is they get the license, and then there is a Visa debit card is issued by one of the bank, and so on and so forth. So this is how they work, okay? So they're not the bank, but they're trying to provide the services through some other bank. Okay. What we observe now is that most of the new banks, they are trying to become a real banks. Okay? So they're trying to get the full banking license and start to operate as the real banks. So for example, there is a Danish venture called Lunar, or Lunar Way. So this is a citation that I took from the web. You will not be able to find it, but this is, I can assure you that this is the exact citation which I took from their web page last year, basically. Okay, so they say that at Lunar Way, we're innovating the banking experience and the way we all think about money and spending it in our everyday life. And then I highlighted it, so we're not a bank, we're better. Okay, so this is a 2015 venture born in Aarhus, so it's an app-based fintech. So they were purely using only the mobile application for the access to their financial services. And then before basically the end of the last year, they were partnering with the licensed NewCredit Bank, which is the Denmark's largest financial institution. And it was founded in the 1800s. Okay, so it's probably one of the oldest financial institutions and one of the largest in Denmark. Okay, so all the bank license products were going through this NewCredit Bank. So in 2020, things change, okay? So now, if you go to their web page, if you Google them up, and this is one of the front pages that you will find, they say that we're just as any other Danish bank under the supervision of the Danish financial supervisory authority, okay? So the Danish FSA issued basically a banking license to the Lunar Way, so now they're just as any other bank, okay? And they got this license in the term of 2019. Okay, so this is a very common example how the new banks kind of transform nowadays to the new banks, to the full digital bank. So they want to have their own banking license as well. Okay, and then the last part of the elements of all this is actually about the non-banks fintechs, right? So there are actually several sub-elements of this non-bank fintechs, but essentially we can talk about two primary parts, right? The first one is the payments, right? So we've seen a very disruptive technology which is available roughly from 2014 to the broader audience. So for example, like Apple Pay or Mobile Pay or Google Pay and so on and so forth. So essentially these guys, they came up with the technology, right? So you can pay with your smartphone or even with your watch, okay, which is completely nuts in my opinion. I mean, nobody could imagine that you would be able to make a financial transaction using your watch, all right? So this is something which is completely fantastic, I think. But essentially the problem here is that these guys charge roughly, it varies, of course, from technology, from bank to the merchant agreement, but the average transaction costs roughly either 0.05% or then up to 0.3% of the transaction. Okay, this is how much the bank pays, right, to the providers of the services. So they actually eat up pretty big chunk of the fee income from the financial institutions. All right, so obviously banks had to respond. So they had to come up with these contactless debit cards or credit cards. So you would not have to kind of do more manipulations than just by showing your credit card or debit card, right? But essentially, the debit cards nowadays, for security reasons, they have a limit of 50 euros, right? So at least in Finland, you can pay with your credit card or debit card contactless up to 50 euros. So Apple Pay essentially is limitless. All right? So if you have your iPhone, you can make whatever transaction through your iPhone because it's more secure. It requires another authentication. The space for the thief, some sort of shady activities, is not that big over there, right? So nobody can charge your card distantly or charge your phone distantly. So in the US, they are developing right now. I think this technology is not available still in Europe, but at least in the United States, there is an Apple Cash, all right? So they're trying to substitute the physical cash where they basically offer some sort of a money transfer through the iMessages, right? So you don't need to have anything else, but just open your iMessage in your iPhone and basically do some manipulations there and you're done, right? So this is disruptive, okay? All right, and then the second part of this non-bank activities or non-bank fintechs is the lending, right? So we've seen a huge uptick in the number of so-called P2P lending platforms. So P2P is peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer lending platforms are popping up like mushrooms after a rain in the forest. Okay, so right now, the biggest example probably would be the Lending Club. Okay, so this one operates in the US, but I'm sure, this is something that we can get data on, right? So, but I'm sure there are actually bigger clubs or bigger lending platforms for somewhere, for instance, in China, which we actually don't really have the data on. So that's why we kind of stick with this one. But I'm pretty sure that there are bigger ones. So this one, the Lending Club, it's a lending company with, it claims that it has $50 billion in loans. Okay, $50 billion. I mean, it might be not necessarily the biggest number in terms of the lending amounts, but essentially $50 billion for some sort of a platform, peer-to-peer platform, is quite a lot, right? So what it does is that it allows individuals to create loan listings. So if I'm a private individual, I just go and log in the system and say, hey, I would like to borrow, I don't know, 2,000 euros, for instance, for something, for my summer vacation, let's say. Okay, and then the Lending Club, the platform itself, it's some sort of, has a pre-screening on this listing just to make sure that, I mean, the information is not completely nonsense over there, which is provided. And then it also verifies the borrower. So it asks for the IDs and so on and so forth, just to eliminate any faulty activities in a sense, okay, or fraudulent activities. And then it also screens the credit history to make sure that you're not one of the criminals and a broke person who doesn't have a, or who has a very bad credit history. And then it also assigns some sort of a risk ranks corresponding to your credit history. And then based on these ranks, you will be automatically assigned of interest rate for which you can borrow. Okay. And then in the investor, I mean, private, and it could be private investors or it could be institutional investors, they're on the other side of this platform, right? So they can also log in, they can see the listings, and then they can choose whom they would like to lend with the given interest rate that which is available, which is calculated by the platform, right? So they decide how much they want to fund, whether they fund 100% of your loan or only a fraction. So there is a current requirement of something like $25 should be minimum allocation amount to each of the listings. So this is how it works, okay? So again, this is not a bank. So they don't have a bank license. They actually have very few things to do with the banking activities, but essentially they try to kind of create some sort of another way of obtaining loans, right? So, and as I told you, I mean, these things are popping up like mushrooms after the rain in the forest. So this is data as of February last year, okay? And this is the number of the registered fintech startups around the world. Okay, so this part is only for the both of the Americas, and this is for the I think it was for the emerging markets, and this is for Asian Pacific region, and so on and so forth. So this is European markets are here as well. So you can see that more than 12,000, if you combine more than 12,000 specialized fintech firms in the wide areas from payments to the P2P lendings or insurance or investments or management services, they kind of, they're existing right now, okay? So the biggest questions here, and what we're observing right now is that this number is growing basically every day, okay? Every now and then there's another fintech startup which pops up there or there in many different geographical locations. So the biggest question here is that, do this startup, do this fintech really compete with the banking sector, or do they rather complement to the traditional banking activities? And I guess the ultimate question here is, will this fintechs be able to replace the real banks in the future? Okay. So the biggest, one of the other questions here is what's happening with the traditional financial intermediation functions, okay? So especially when we're talking about the B2B platforms, we actually do not know what's happened, how the financial intermediation works now, right? Simply because there is no intermediation. There is a platform which allows to meet the investors and the private borrowers, and that's about it, okay? So it has huge implications for the regulatory authorities, for instance, for the financial stability in particular, because the platform, if in case of the banks, we actually observe all the exposure to the different types of the risk on the bank's balance sheets. So in case of the P2P platforms, we simply don't see that, right? So we do not know what's happening because they're not keeping this transactions from their balance sheets or income statement, right? So they're kind of so-called disintermediate the market, the financial transaction, financial services market. Okay, so let's see what's happening with this financial intermediation and how this digital disruption affects this financial intermediations. So I didn't check Zoom, but let me see. Are there any questions so far, or are there any comments?
Yes, I think that there are some questions in the chat. If you want to answer those now, then you can take a look at the chat. There's at least three questions there.
Okay, good. Let me just figure out how I open my...
I think you can start from the Amaya's question there. Are you able to see it?
Yeah, here it is. Okay, so this one, right? So considering the people who have had more conventional training in the banking field with digitalization, are banks looking to completely letting them go, or are they leaning more towards retraining and upscaling them? So this is a very good question. So banks are not shut in their kind of own room, right? So they're not the ones who are sitting there and do not hear or do not see anything, right? So they try to catch up. If you just hold for a second, I think I will answer your question with the following few slides that I have, okay? So, and how's scalable the digital banking or the digital disruption behind it? Blockchain allows for a lot more transparency and accessibility, but isn't very sustainable in its verification methods. That's correct. So, again, blockchain is only a very, very small element in the digital banks right now. Okay, so the digital banks are much more than just the blockchain technology. You're right, and the reason for that is exactly what you mentioned. So there are some actually drawbacks in, for instance, the verification methods. But essentially, the blockchain technology allows banks to do much more. Okay, so the technology as such is, I think, it's fantastic, and essentially, it in the future, at some stage, it probably will be heavily used, or it would be impossible to imagine a bank without this technology. But how scalable it is? Well, it's a difficult question because we're actually living in these times right now. We're living in the times when banks try to scale, or these new players in the market, they try to scale this technology. They try to scale the market and the company, the banks kind of, and try to offer this product. Again, in the next few slides, I will show you what's happening basically with the fintechs in a sense, in terms of the scaling or replacing, ability to replace the financial services market. Okay, so the last question in the chat, is the owner base for these new banks usually the same as the base for the traditional banks they're partnering with? And especially if not, will this the incentive to the traditional bank to partner up with the new bank if they become competitors. Yeah, so this is also a very good question. If you remember this Danish startup, so the Lunar Way, so the thing is that originally the bank behind it was affiliated with the owners of the Lunar Way. Okay, so essentially the Lunar Way was created in a sense by the former employees of the bank. All right. So, but this is rather uncommon. Okay, so of course there are plenty of stories like that, but most of the time, why banks want to partner? Well, simply because even if they're not affiliated in terms of the ownership or some other stakes, so that simply because they want to be up to date with the technology. All right. So I think banks essentially realize that this is the future, and if you're partnering with one of these fancy fintech startups, most likely you will be also part of this market in the future as well, right? So either you get an access to the technology that they're using, or then and so you would not have to develop this technology within in-house in a sense. So you will get an access to that through this partnership, or then you simply kind of watch and learn, basically, right? So you basically trying to figure out how this model works and whether it works at all, because all these startups, they're extremely risky. Okay, so whatever fintech startup you take, they're extremely risky, and sometimes the risk is so excessive that none of the banks can take it. Okay, and this is again for the regulatory and supervisory reasons. So they have this regulatory burden that they have to have certain level of safety and stability, simply, and this is why they simply cannot take any additional risk on their books. So if they start implementing this in-house and starting to play with the risky games like this, I mean, the central bank would come and say, hey, you're playing too hard with this, so you shouldn't be doing that. Most likely this is what's going to happen. So that's kind of the incentive. Right, so they understand that this is the competition, and instead of trying to compete with them, with the direct competitors, they try to kind of be involved, to get involved in the sense of this one. So for that reason, it's a win-win situation. So the non-banks, they get an access to the bank licensed products, and then the banks actually get on the wave of this innovation in the financial service. Okay, so I think that's it. If there are no more questions, let's go on. Okay, so let's talk about this financial intermediation. So this is the very conventional financial intermediation model. Okay, so we have the intermediary bank here. We have the depositors. We also have the debt holders and the shareholders. And then we have on the other side, we have the borrowers. Okay, so this is very simple, very simplified version of the conventional financial intermediation kind of function, right? So what is happening here is that the depositors bring deposits to the bank, then the debt holders, they may issue some sort of uninsured debt, and then the shareholders, they bring the equity, right? So the intermediary bank is backed up by the equity holders of this, all right? And then the bank makes the loans to the borrower. So when it comes to the repayment, so obviously the borrowers, they pay interest rate on their loans, so the bank gets some sort of repayment from them, and based after all the deductions and so on and so forth, so of course they pay first the interest on the deposit, right? So they transfer some sort of a fraction to the depositors, and then whatever is left after all the other repayments to the debt holders, whatever is left after deducting all the costs of running the bank, so the residual earnings go to the shareholders, right? As some sort of a return on equity. So at the same time, the bank is responsible for risk assessment and monitoring, and at some stage it becomes responsible for or establishing the relationship banking, so-called relationship banking, so some sort of relationships, which are not necessarily based on the hard data, but also in the soft information. information as well with their borrowers. And then the what is kind of essential here is that the financial intermediary, the conventional financial intermediation, it keeps all the credit risk, interest rate risk, currency risk, all the other types of the risk associated with this activity on its books, right? So essentially for the regulators, it's very easy. Looking at the financial statement of the bank, it's very easy to assess what's the exposure of this or that financial institution to the, for example, to the particular type of the risk. And then essentially they are able to calculate what's the systemic risk in the sector in general, and what's the exposure of individual bank to this, or what's the contribution of the individual bank to the systemic risk in the market. Okay, so this is conventional structure. Let's see what happens when we have fintech instead of the bank. So now, instead of the bank, we have the P2P lending platform, for instance. Let's take it as an example. So instead of the depositors, we have investors, right? So the investors, instead of the deposits, they make investments. And then the P2P platforms kind of transfer this investment, or they're not transfer, but they kind of allow to meet these investors with individual borrowers. And then this is how the loans flow, right? So essentially the P2P platform does not have any debt holders. It does have the shareholders, of course, but shareholders, essentially, they're not involved in the process of the main financial intermediation process. Okay. So they do not invest their own money, for example, into something, whatever the P2P platform is involved in. They're just using it as some sort of building up the platform itself, for instance. So we can get rid of this part, right? So simply because it doesn't exist there. There are no flows essentially. Probably the shareholders get some sort of repayment, but it's not essential in our example. Okay, so then what is different as well is that this risk assessment and monitoring and relationship banking is completely absent from this kind of digital way of making the disintermediation in a sense. Okay, so they do some sort of a pre-screening, but this pre-screening is very limited to the fact that basically it's a real person and not a dog who is asking for money, right? And then they're also just making sure that it's some sort of a legal activity. But essentially, they did not do some sort of additional assessment of the trustworthiness of the customer. They did not consider the length of the relationships with the how it would happen with the bank, for instance. They do not look at the savings behavior or investments behavior of the borrowers. They simply look on their credit history, whether the person was able to repay its debt before or not. And this is how they assign this is how they decide on the interest rates. And then another part, if we simplify this model a little bit now, so if you just put it in a line, so we have investors, we have the P2P platform, but essentially the P2P platform does not take any risks on itself books, but it's rather kind of allows to meet the investor and borrower, and essentially all the associated risks are now handled by the investor themselves. Okay, so the repayments make some sort of from the borrowers to the investors. They are pretty much made directly to the investors, and then of course the P2P platform keeps some sort of a fraction for its services. And as I said, they simply do the pre-screening based on the hard data most of the time, instead of building the relationship with the bank and so on and so forth. So this is how it looks, and this is basically what we can call it, is that it's a financial disintermediation, right? Simply because this guy in the middle here does not take anything associated with its activity on its balance sheet or on its income statement, basically. So it's just a platform in a sense. So, and this is in a nutshell, this is how the things are different between the conventional banks and non-bank fintechs, okay? So the banks, most of the time, they do some sort of a pooling of the risk, and then they're trying to share this risk across different types of the parties or multiple types of the parties. They're also doing monitoring. So whenever the loan is issued, they also monitor this loan until it's repaid. So the non-bank fintechs, They don't pretty much care what happens after the loan has been issued. They did not do any monitoring. So if the investor, if the borrower stops repaying its loan at some stage, then basically it's an investor's headache, right? So the platforms, they do not pretty much care about that. So important, the most important part is the liquidity creation, probably. So liquidity creation is for the conventional banks is one of the central kind of aspects, one of the central types of the activities, functions of the banks in general. So non-bank fintechs, they did not take the deposits, right? So they did not keep the deposits on their books, and that's why they did not create any liquidity. So it's totally, completely up to the investors and the borrowers whether they decide and how much they decide to borrow or lend. Okay, so the loan commitments, you'll probably also, it would be a complete surprise for me if any P2P platform would offer you a loan commitment. Okay, so at the moment, at least, it doesn't exist. Maturity transformation, obviously. Banks take, for example, short-term deposits, and then they can convert the short-term deposits into long-term loans. They can give out long-term loans, right? And simply because there are so many of these different types of deposits and there's a constant flow of these deposits, they can allow themselves to make these loans longer in maturity. So for the P2P platforms, this is not a question, right? So they, first of all, they are not involved with any, they put nothing on their books, right? So they're not transforming anything. So again, it's completely up to the investor and to the borrower. And then there's, of course, there is a deposit insurance difference. So whatever you bring to the bank in form of the deposit, it's always going to be insured. In most of the countries, it's going to be insured at least to a certain extent. And then whatever you bring to the P2P platform, never going to be insured, right? Simply because you are now the investor. And then I'm not going to mention this particular differences about the leverage and equity or all equity finance and what's the regulator board burden. So all these are kind of clear aspects here. So the question here, what is better, right? So which model is better? So it's interesting that this disruption did not actually originate from the financial sector, but at some stage it started to heat up in the financial sector quite a lot. But essentially, for example, if you look at all other technological disruptions in the world, you would actually notice that, for instance, Uber is the world's largest transportation company right now. I mean, in retail sector, right? So, but essentially, it owns no cars. It doesn't have any of its own cars on its balance sheets. All right. So the Facebook, again, it's the world's most popular media, probably. And what's fascinating is that it simply does not create any content. Okay, so it just provides you a platform where people can share little things. And then Airbnb, for instance, another huge disruption in the leisure industry. So it's one of the largest accommodation providers right now, but essentially it owns no real estate. So it doesn't have any of these assets on its balance sheet at all. So the question here, can the provider of the banking service or the financial services exist and function normally with such a thin balance sheet? Okay, so this is kind of a question which is kind of being tested right now, okay? Because this is what we observe. So the ultimate question, right? So as probably many of you would wonder, and many of the regulators are wondering, is will these intermediaries replace the financial intermediaries, if not now, but in some sort of nearest future? So we can look at it from two perspectives. So the first one would be based on some sort of theoretical predictions. So when we are talking about the banks, all of them are some sort of leveraged lenders. Either they use the debt issued in order to finance their loans, or then it comes in form of the deposits, right? From the depositors, from the retail or corporate depositors, doesn't matter. So they're essentially leveraged lenders. So they do not lend their own money, but they lend someone else's money, all right? And then for this exact reason, they have a risk-shifting moral hazard. And of course, it's framed by the regulatory requirements. But essentially, whenever there is some sort of issue with their leverage for the banks, or there are certain new requirements, or certain shocks to the availability, to the supply of this leverage funds, all these features most likely going to be shifted or transferred to the borrower. Right, so the banks do not have to take the burden themselves. So P2P platforms in terms, they're all equity lenders. Okay, so they're taking the investors' money and actually investors are lending to the borrowers directly through this P2P platform. So for that reason, they do not have such a moral hazard, right? So investors, individual investors, are free to decide whatever, right? So whenever they want to withdraw, they would, or I don't think that they can withdraw from the loan, but whenever they think that they would stop lending money on this platform, they will stop. And if they feel like going, they will continue investing this money to the private borrowers, right? So whenever there is some sort of an exogenous shock in the credit supply, so that theoretically banks, should cut their lending, right? Simply because they do not have, or they have less money available for lending. Potentially, on the other side, these P2P platforms, they may offer some sort of a substitute effect, because these exogenous shocks are not necessarily related to individual depositors or to the individual investors or lenders. And if you have a certain amount of these lenders, then most likely, you will be less exposed to these exogenous shocks, right? So this is what the theory predicts in our case. So let's look at the empirical evidence. So there are, again, I told you in the beginning that there is a very, very few empirical evidence on the topic, but at least there is some. So let's try to pull something out of this available evidence. So there is a paper in the Review of Financial Studies published last year. So what they found is that P2P lending actually expands in the markets which are exposed to the negative bank credit supply shock. Okay, so they observed that the P2P platforms, they grow faster and they appear faster, they develop faster in the markets where the banks face more often and the bigger credit supply shocks. Okay. But essentially, these expansions benefit only to the very, very small fraction of the bank borrowers. Okay, so basically, this evidence shows that the P2P platforms are not able to replace bank lending, even if there is a big credit supply shock. So only a very, very small marginal group of people who borrow from bank now were able to borrow from the P2P platforms. So in that sense, it's some sort of, it's more of a complement to the bank credit and only in form of the smaller loans, right? And most likely retail loans. So there is another paper, it used to be a working paper. I haven't seen it published yet. Maybe just I missed it somehow. But in any case, this is a very good paper as well. So what they found is that if banks are affected by some sort of exogenous shocks, then P2P lenders will fill the gap with this missing credit, but only if there are no unaffected financially strong banks in the system left. Okay, so if, in other words, if all the banks are affected at the same time in the system, then P2P lenders can somehow substitute this decrease in the lending activity, right, of the banks. But if there is a one big player or several big players, which are, for example, state-owned banks, for instance, right, which are backed up by the governments, and obviously governments would like to be financial institutions a little bit less pro-cyclical or more counter-cyclical, so probably they would make the funds available for their banks in order to kind of stimulate additional lending to the market during the some sort of exogenous shock events. So what they found also is that the P2P lenders make riskier loans than banks, okay? So this is some sort of also implications for the financial stability feature. And while this risk-adjusted interest rate is actually lower on bank loans, Well, that makes sense, right? So the higher the risk, the higher premium you would require. But still, I mean, what is better? To have some sort of available, more expensive option when the bank loan is not available for you. And then, of course, there's a higher risk involved, higher credit risk, and all the other possible kind of solvency risk, for instance, which are not observed by the regulators, right? Simply because the P2P platforms did not keep it on their balances. But it may have, after reaching certain size, it may have actually systemic exposures as well to the rest of the market. So this is what we've seen. This is what the empirical evidence as of today tells us, right? So essentially the P2P platforms are not really the substitutes, but they're rather complements and very, very specific types of the complements of the bank when it comes at least to the lending activities. Okay, so let's look at how the new banks, so this is kind of a semi-digital banks. So these are the banks which are digital, but they do not have a banking license. They kind of pretend to be a bank in a sense, but they're not. So what happens with their financial intermediation function? So again, we have the depositors. So depositors kind of bring the money to this new bank, but new bank is not allowed to take deposits simply because it doesn't have a banking license. And that's why it has to partner with, for example, with the traditional bank. And through this traditional bank, it would be able to take deposits, or the deposits will be stored at this traditional bank. And then when it comes to the borrowers part, then it's actually, again, the new banks are not allowed to make loans themselves. Because of the absence of the banking license. And that's why they have to partner with the traditional bank in order to be able to do that. So that's why there is like this two smaller dots which make the financial intermediation even more intermediation or even more intermediated. So instead of having only one intermediary, now you have three intermediaries that kind of operate in the financial intermediation feature. So the key feature here is the absence of the bank license, right? So they're simply not allowed to do these traditional banking activities. And also they're, for this exactly this reason, they're able to transfer the risk and regulatory burden that the banks have. So the new bank, most of the time, it's a very, very fancy wrap for the financial services which are provided by the real traditional banks. Okay, so they're probably, most likely they're doing it more efficient, providing the services. Most likely they're doing it in a nicer way. The user experience is very nice, but essentially it's the same financial intermediation feature which the traditional banks do. Okay, so yeah, and most often the new banks, they deliver just the service and not the product, simply because they cannot create any product themselves because of the regulations, but they are able to wrap the services by these products in a fancy kind of frame and then sell it to the market. Okay, let's see what's the impact of this financial intermediation and what are the key takeaways. So for non-banks, for P2P platforms, for instance, or for other fintech companies, which are not real banks, we see the so-called disintermediation, right? So they're trying to get rid of this middle part, and they're trying to connect the borrowers and lenders, for example, directly. So, and again, the theoretical predictions and the empirical evidence so far, it shows that this can be some sort of a complementary function to the traditional banking. The biggest problem here probably is that they do not keep the risks that they originate on their books, right? So they basically, they're not interested what happens with the loan afterwards, but they're rather interested in creating some sort of a meeting place where the borrower and lender would be able to make a deal, okay? So then there are neobanks. Those are so-called indirect intermediation or additional intermediation, if you wish. So they rather supplement to the traditional banks. They're definitely not the substitute, because without the traditional bank, conventional banks, they will not be able, there will be nothing to wrap in this fancy frame, right? So, and then all the risks associated with the activity of the neobanks, they're actually kept on the balance sheets of the conventional banks. Okay, and then for the new banks or the fully digital banks, so these guys have they try to come up with the place where most of the services can be provided at one place. And they obviously, they can do it in a more efficient way to provide the services. But what we see, what we observe today is that they have a very, very limited scope of services. And most of the time, there are kind of some of the services, at least, they are outsourced to other banks or some other institutions. And then still the scale of these banks is rather limited. So, so essentially all these three elements of the digital banks, they can be characterized with the ability to provide the service that the traditional banks do less efficiently or do not do at all. So, for example, they have smaller households, for instance, in some very distant locations, who did not have an access to the banking services because there is no physical branch, now are able to basically open a bank account or kind of a bank account using some sort of a fintech. This has a huge implications for the financial inclusion, and we actually know from the literature that financial inclusion is directly linked to the economic development and economic growth and so on and so forth. So this is kind of a win-win situation here. But essentially all these elements, they at this stage, they cannot replace banks in most of their key functions. Okay, so both the empirical evidence shows that banks are not able, or non-banks, fintechs are not able to replace banks in most of their functions. And we actually have seen that some of the banks or some of the fintechs are not able to fully provide the services which are available on the for the bank customers today. Okay, any questions? I'll make a quick stop now again and check in the questions. So no new messages I see. Okay, so I think we're running out of time. We have roughly 2 minutes left. So that's why I think I'm gonna leave this part for tomorrow. So, but if you guys have any questions or any comments on what we were talking so far, feel free. We have 2 minutes, and we can open up the discussion if there is something to discuss during this time.
Okay, many thanks, Dennis. It was a very nice lecture. So, if any one of you have any questions to Dennis now, please open your microphone. You can ask them loud or write to the chat.
Wow, so many questions. Hold on a second. I don't keep up with your speed.
I think there are actually no new questions in the chat.
Yeah. That's what I noticed as well. But, well, okay. I think if no questions, now we can pretty much finish for today, and we'll continue tomorrow from where we stopped.
Okay. Many thanks, Dennis, and see you all tomorrow, 12:15.